UCCF's Be Thinking website, bethinking.org, offers you free access to some of the finest apologetics resources in the world. Make sure you sign up as a BeThinker to receive our monthly email. The BeThinking email is packed with handy information highlighting new articles, film, book and music reviews, and is filled with practical examples of how you can make good use of the excellent and insightful material on BeThinking.org to help you grow as a thinking Christian. BeThinkers combine a good understanding of the issues with a character that shows that the biblical truths that the BeThinker describes are authentic and life-changing. Log on to BeThinking.org and become a BeThinker today.
Are we on here okay? Good. Do let me know. Please come and sit in the front. You know, you'll be just the one person back there. So that's it. Please do let me know if I don't speak loud enough, simply because of the hearing problem I have. I sound to myself like I'm shouting. To everybody else, this is rather quiet, so if I drop my voice too much, just tell me to speak up. Let's pray together, shall we? Heavenly Father, we thank you for this lovely day. We thank you for the joy of meeting each other, of thinking together, and we pray that we may think your thoughts are after you. As we meet together now, we thank you for Tolkien and the gifts you gave him and the blessing he has been to us and to so many millions of people around the world. Make this time fruitful to us, we pray, for Jesus' sake. Amen. Has everybody, by the way, got a evaluation to fill out afterwards? Good. Okay, we'll try and stop and leave you a couple of minutes for that at the end. Please do stop me and ask questions as we go along if you want to, either for clarification or development or whatever. Obviously, to try to talk about Tolkien in just simply one-hour lecture is very challenging. To try to reduce his remarkable output into some kind of manageable size and at the same time give you a reasonable sort of introduction. My first acquaintance with Tolkien's writings personally was when my father read The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings aloud to us at home. I suppose I was in my early teens when the books came out. He used to read to us every night, and though he was a man with very little formal education, he read wonderfully well, and it's something I have never forgotten, and I have loved those books ever since. My second acquaintance with Tolkien was when I went to study English language and literature at Manchester University in the middle 60s. Most of my textbooks were written by Tolkien in the field of ancient Germanic languages, which I was studying, Gothic and Icelandic and Anglo-Saxon. And Tolkien, of course, was the primary scholar in that area and still regarded as one of the greatest scholars in that field. So that's my own personal background, and I have loved the writings of Tolkien ever since, and I suppose read The Lord of the Rings many, many times, as you could tell by my books here, which have to be held together by rubber bands because they're so frequently read. But Tolkien, I'm sure you're here because you love his writings, and you've probably seen the movies. And as we think about that, Tolkien has become increasingly popular since these books first came out in the 1950s. Today, I suppose, The Lord of the Rings has sold by now around 50 million copies, something like that, and more all the time because of the popularity of the movies. That's 50 million copies in English, and of course the books have been translated as well into many languages. As you know, the films have been extraordinarily popular, the films that Peter Jackson directed, and really remarkably well done in terms of realizing the vision that's present in Tolkien's books. So Tolkien's been extraordinarily popular, so much so that at the turn of the millennium, Tolkien won in Britain the any survey done for the man of the century, the author of the century of the 20th century. And many of the literati who wanted to do the survey were deeply offended by the fact that Tolkien won it, and they wanted somebody like James Joyce or Virginia Woolf to win it, and so they kept redoing the survey to try to get different results. But no matter how they asked the questions, Tolkien came out ahead, much to some people's disgust. Those of you who are British will know, just in the last few months, there's been another program on British television addressing the question of the best-loved author of the English, of the British people. And again, Tolkien won this. Now, what are some of the reasons for Tolkien's popularity and the impact of these books? Because they're not just simply popular. They're books which people love and which many people feel impact their own lives very deeply. How did a professor at Oxford, a scholar of dead languages, become such a widely read author whose books have now been made into this remarkable trilogy of movies? Now, for Christians who work in the arts, and that may be true of some of you, we should note that Tolkien had the courage to create a new form of literature. Basically, The Lord of the Rings is a kind of literature which had never been attempted in quite the same way before. And this creation, of course, has now been copied by many, many imitators, some fine and some not so great, of course. But this creation is copied, which is the sincerest form of flattery, of course, but also enjoyed by many, many millions of both Christians and many more millions of non-Christians. Now, this should particularly, I think, draw our attention at a time when it's not at all easy in our societies to speak publicly about our Christian faith. So it's a fascinating thing that a Christian writer like Tolkien should have written something that is so accessible to unbelievers and such a joy to them. What are some of the reasons for the popularity? And let me suggest a few to you. First, what I've called here the thoroughly realized world of Middle-earth. One of the remarkable things about reading Tolkien is that he has created another world for us. Of course, it's our world at some long ago time in the past, in the way he presents it to us. But he's created another world for us which is extraordinarily well realized. It's a world in which one can make maps of it. He made some himself, of course. Other authors I got for my boys when I read The Lord of the Rings to them for the first time, when they were quite small, I got them a book with Journeys of Frodo on it, where an author had produced this full-length book with maps. And because Tolkien's landscape is so carefully drawn and his journeys are spelled out in such detail, it's quite possible to draw extraordinarily detailed maps on the basis simply of the text itself. A landscape that we can delight in, a landscape that we feel that we are ourselves exploring as we read his stories. In addition to that landscape, that geography, if we like, Tolkien has also given us in these books a history of peoples and kingdoms going back for thousands of years. And this is one of the aspects of the book that particularly delights those interested in such things, because one can look at the appendix and you can read about people's ancestors going back many, many generations, people who don't come into the story at all, but he has this background there for you. And this is one of the things that gives such extraordinary depth to these books. They're not in any way shallow. So geography, history, and also cultures. Cultures that we can imagine entering and living in. I'm sure some of you have dreamt about entering some of these cultures, and that's always some kind of indication of the power of a writer when people start dreaming and imagining themselves entering into the cultures which are described in these books. And in addition, of course, languages. One or two of you may have even made the attempt to learn one of Tolkien's languages and communicate in it. You may know that there are whole societies of people who do. You can find websites where people are writing letters to each other in various kinds of Elvish or whatever it happens to be. And of course, if you know anything about the history of Tolkien producing this work, you will know that that's where Tolkien began, because from his childhood he had loved languages. Even when he was still in school in Birmingham, in England, he was learning languages like Gothic, a language which has been dead for 1,500 years. The only text we have in Gothic is a translation by Ulfilas of the Bible. But Tolkien learnt this language. It wasn't something he was taught, to the point where he could give speeches in it and speak spontaneously in it in public debates in his grammar school where he was a student. So Tolkien began with languages, creating the languages for these peoples. But at first they were simply languages. One of the Elvish languages he modeled in its structure on Welsh, another on Finnish. But the languages themselves are original languages which work. They have their own, even their history of sound changes and development. They work thoroughly. You can write books in them. You can have conversations in them. But they are his own generation, we may put it that way. He has generated them entirely. And that's where he began, by creating these languages. Then he began to write poems, like the Lay of Beren and Lúthien, poems in which there were characters who spoke these languages which he had designed. That was the second stage in his work of creation, poems for his characters to speak the languages he had designed. And then he worked on the full development of those characters and finally came up with a world in which to set them. So the story itself of The Lord of the Rings comes very far down the road in terms of the development of his work of creation. And it's this extraordinary amount of time. He started writing, creating these languages back in the 1920s. The books are finally published in the 50s. It's this enormous amount of work that goes into this realization, full realization of cultures and peoples and their history and so on, which gives these books such depth. And it's one of the things that draws people back to the books again and again, because you certainly don't exhaust these books by one or two or three or even four or five readings. There's always far more to discover. That brings me to a second point, and I think many readers don't notice this until they read the books many, many times. One of the problems I find, I won't call it a problem, but one of the facts I find in reading The Lord of the Rings is the story is so well told that even when you're thoroughly familiar with it, it's such a good story that you start reading it faster and faster because it's carrying you along, and that can stop you noticing all sorts of things that Tolkien is doing as the story develops. And I have to make a conscious effort to read it slowly, to actually see what he's doing and enjoy it more fully than simply getting captivated by the story each time. Not that I mind being captivated, that's of course a good thing, but there are things that I'm going to miss if I'm not careful. And so the second point I want to make here is what I'm going to call this constant subtle tie into our own world. The world of the Shire is the world of rural England, and especially it is the world of the West Midlands, near Birmingham, where Tolkien spent most of his childhood. He was born in South Africa. His mother moved with him and his brother to England when he was very small, and he spent the next years of his life there in the West Midlands. But the place names of the Shire, the names of the people, like Gamgee, for example, the cultural habits of the people, of the hobbits, they are the cultural habits of the area where Tolkien spent his childhood. And even some of the the events that happen in the Shire are taken from things that Tolkien remembers as a child. Now, for those of you who are English, I hope you don't take it as a kind of piece of rudeness that I suggest that Tolkien has based his Hobbits on us, those of us who are English, but indeed he did. And many of their characteristics, one recognizes oneself in them as you read about Hobbits. But it's not just simply that element which reminds us of our own time. Tolkien was also consciously creating a myth for the English. And that is one of the reasons why there are so many quiet, hardly noticed side references to the present time and place. He may say, for example, that you only rarely see elves today, but you hardly notice these kinds of statements, but there are actually a significant number of them in the books. So Tolkien was consciously creating a myth for the English, and on your notes there you'll see a quotation here from him. He's writing about the mythological ballads of Europe, and he says, "These mythological ballads are full of that very primitive undergrowth that the literature of Europe has on the whole been steadily cutting and reducing for many centuries with different and earlier completeness among different people. I would that we had more of it left, something of the same sort that belonged to the English." Now, it's exactly that that Tolkien has sought to do in The Lord of the Rings, to create this kind of primitive undergrowth, this mythological background, as a kind of early history of the English people. That's one of his desires in making The Lord of the Rings. And because that's one of his desires, there's a constant evocation of our present world as one reads through these stories. And this, of course, is one of the things that draws one in, and we may not even notice it. I certainly didn't notice it the first few times I read these books. That brings me to a third point here, unforgettable characters. You may pick your favorite. Some of you, perhaps, much to your surprise, may have decided after watching the movies that Gollum is your favorite, which would be an interesting choice, but simply because it's so extraordinarily well done, he's so extraordinarily well presented in the movies. I think that's one of the remarkable aspects of the work of Peter Jackson in the film. But many characters, a whole gallery of characters that one may delight in and imagine oneself speaking to. Fourthly, this is a wonderfully told story. As I've already said, every time I read it, I find myself reading it faster and faster, simply because the story itself is such a captivating story into which I get drawn. I've put here a quote from Jane Austen, which you may feel doesn't apply in any way, but I will explain why I've put it here. Jane Austen wrote about her own writing as the little bit 2 inches wide of ivory on which I work with so fine a brush as to produce little effect after much labor. Jane Austen wrote about a very narrow part of life and very purposefully. It was the part of life that she, as an individual, was acquainted with. And she kept working and reworking until she got her novels to a state close to perfection. Now, of course, in Tolkien's case, it's certainly not a little bit of ivory 2 inches wide on which he is painting with a fine brush. Instead of a tiny little piece of ivory, Tolkien is working on a tapestry which embraces eons of time and vast distances of space. But the quotation is apt because Tolkien worked at The Lord of the Rings in just the same way that Jane Austen worked on her books. That is, he worked on them over and over and over again, trying to bring them to a point where he was satisfied. He was quite a perfectionist, which those of you who struggle with perfectionism will know is not exactly a blessing, though if you can deal with it sufficiently, you may end up producing something quite wonderful. But Tolkien was working year after year after year, night after night. He was up till most nights till 2 in the morning for many, many years working on these books once he had finished his academic work for the day. He would send pieces of his work on The Lord of the Rings to C.S. Lewis to read, particularly to Lewis, who was one of his very dear friends. And sometimes he would read bits that eventually became The Lord of the Rings at the Inklings meetings. If Lewis gave any critique at all to these bits sent through the mail or by hand or heard at the Inklings, even if, as he always did, Lewis mostly gave Tolkien lavish praise for what he had written, but if Lewis made any critique at all, Tolkien would basically rewrite the whole thing, almost every word in it. Any criticism he received, even the warmest, friendliest criticism, he took as a challenge to redo this, and so he worked over and over again on it. He said himself later that if it had not been for the encouragement of C.S. Lewis, he never would have written these books. So he spoke of the incalculable debt, that's what he called it, the incalculable debt that he owed to Lewis for his encouragement as he worked on these books. Another element here is humor. These stories are full of laughter. I'm sure as you think about various parts of the story, it makes you smile. You sit there and you reflect on something and you smile about it. These stories are full of poetry. And again, just like with the characters, you probably, each of you, have your favorite, whether it's some of the rollicking songs loved by the hobbits that they like to sing when they're drinking and eating, whether it's the poetry about Tom Bombadil, a fascinating kind of person who's difficult to place in anybody's notions of the orders of beings in this universe, or the ethereal poetry of the elves, or whether it's the Anglo-Saxon poetry of the people of Rohan. If you are familiar with Anglo-Saxon poetry, with, say, the way Beowulf is written, you will know that the poetry of the Rohirrim is really based on this in terms of its structure and its content, very beautifully done, too. And also its mood, not just the structure and content, the kind of language, but also the mood which pervades that Anglo-Saxon poetry with which Tolkien himself was so thoroughly familiar. Now that brings me to the primary point I want to speak about in terms of why I think these books and the movies made on them somewhat faithfully have such an impact on people. And I've called this section The Quest for Goodness. We live in a world which is deeply broken. And as Christians, we would say, of course, it's broken because of the fall. There is nothing that we experience in our lives which is not touched by the terrible reality of sin and its consequences. And it's this broken reality of our world that is so deeply embedded in these books. A broken reality demonstrated in the ongoing battle between good and evil, light and darkness, kindness and cruelty, mercy and brutality, humility and pride, self-giving and self-serving. That is the tapestry on which this whole story is woven. And it's touching people very, very deeply. As we think about goodness in these stories, we can think about it in a whole series of ways. At the most basic level in The Lord of the Rings, there is a delight in the good things of the daily providence of a good God, the enjoyment of the most ordinary things of life, of food, of drink, of laughter, of fireworks. There is a deep delight in creation, in the beauty of the Shire and other places where we travel on the journey of the Fellowship of the Ring. And not only the beauty of creation itself as it comes to us from the hand of God, but also the beauty of a wise and righteous exercise of dominion over creation. We see this in the lovingly painted landscape of the hobbits in terms of how they themselves live and work on this landscape, respecting it. One of the things Tolkien personally absolutely hated was the damage that industrialization and poor planning in city building does to the landscape in which God has set us. And in these books, we see an absolute delight in this just and wise and righteous exercise of dominion. When we go to Rivendell, for example, this city of the elves fits beautifully into its landscape. And incidentally, this is one of the things that's extraordinarily well realized in Peter Jackson's film. It's the same when we get to Lothlorien, with the flats, the houses of the elves built in these magnificent mallorn trees. As you read of them, you see people who have made something which fits beautifully into their landscape, this wise exercise of dominion. And again, Peter Jackson has realized that in his representation of Lothlorien in the movies. So the love of creation and a wise, careful, and just exercise of dominion. And in opposition to that, we see what those who are evil do to this world in which they live. In the most extreme form, of course, Sauron himself, in terms of what has happened to the landscape of Mordor, where there is the only things that are living are thorns and thistles and other terrible things that inflict wounds on those who try to traverse this landscape. But it is a landscape of ash and of terrible pits and fire. It is the landscape of hell, a landscape of somebody who rules it without any regard whatsoever for the glory of creation. And we say the same thing with Saruman as he gives himself up to evil and what he begins to do to the woods and the land around his Tower of Orthanc. And again, this is extraordinarily well realized in the film, this devastation to creation. So a love of creation and a wise and just exercise of dominion, delight in family and in friendship. We might say that every basic virtue is present in these stories, in this celebration of the ordinary things of life. There is another element as well, of course, and that is the choices of the characters along every step of the road of the Fellowship of the Ring. Tolkien is constantly exploring the issue of significance, of the importance of the choices we make for good or for evil, and the way they then set the patterns of our lives from this point onwards, and what that does to other people. Think, for example, of the many choices of Sam. He actually has a section of the book called The Choices of Master Samwise, the choices that Sam makes, or the choice of Boromir when he tries to wrest the ring from Frodo and then repents of that in the most wonderful way, the choices of Gimli or Legolas, even the choices of Gollum. And that's one of the fascinating things about this story. Here is a character who is so depraved, yet when he begins to be treated well by Frodo and kindly, it has an extraordinary impact on his character. And then we see him wrestling between these two personalities, his schizophrenia of Sméagol and Gollum, where the old hobbit begins to reemerge in the person of Sméagol and the wickedness of Gollum. And we see that what happens to him when Sam is so unkind and rude to him. One of the readers once wrote to Tolkien and said how distressed they were by Sam's behavior, and said to him, "Do you think that if Sam hadn't behaved this way, that it might have been possible for Gollum to come to repentance and to be made new?" And Tolkien wrote back and said, "Yes, I think it would have been. Oh, even this character could have been redeemed." That was the point that he was making. So we see the enormous significance of our choices as we go through life. That I quoted Schaeffer in our lecture in Christian Society this morning, that he used to say that every moment of our lives we are casting stones into a pool that make ripples that go on for eternity. And that's the understanding of our significance, of the value of our choices that we find in these stories. And that brings me to another point here. Behind every decision that is made by the characters in these books stands the unseen realm of heaven and of hell. Another way to put this would be this, that even though God is only mentioned explicitly once in 12 or 1300 pages, mentioned in the scene in which Gandalf confronts the Balrog on the stone bridge in Moria just before he plunges down to his death, even though God is only mentioned once explicitly, God is always present. God invisibly at work, fulfilling his purposes through his divine providence and his sovereign rule over history, yet doing this work without violating, as the Westminster Confession puts it, the will of his creatures. What Tolkien is evoking here is what the book of Ecclesiastes calls eternity in our hearts. That which touches people very, very deeply. And for many people, I think they have no idea that that's what's happening to them as they read these stories. That they are having a sense brought into their inner being of this world, this unseen world behind the world in which we live. This is another element which is so clear, the more carefully you read these books, in terms of thinking about the pursuit of goodness. Over and over again, Tolkien, he doesn't use the words like divine providence and sovereignty, but that's what he's talking about. And he comes back to this issue over and over again, particularly from the mouth of Gandalf, but also sometimes in the words of Sam and Frodo. That brings me to another point here as we think about this conflict between good and evil. Tolkien explores the temptation of power. One might say that these books are an elaboration of the theme of how power corrupts people and how absolute power corrupts them absolutely. Those are the words, I suppose, of Lord Acton talking about the corrupting nature of power. And this is something that Tolkien deals with, the temptations of power. We see Galadriel wrestling with the temptation of power, just briefly, when Frodo gladly offers to give her the ring and says, "You can handle this much better than I." And she speaks of herself, of the kind of terrible queen that she would become, beautiful and terrible and ultimately, of course, wicked. In that section called The Choices of Master Samwise, which I referred to earlier, you see Sam momentarily having visions of himself as Samwise the Magnificent striding across the landscape. And of course it's amusing to read it, as well as rather serious, and it's Sam's both goodness and common sense which makes him see the folly of the temptation of power for him. Of course, this temptation of power is what leads Boromir into such trouble, and eventually, of course, to his own death, though a death which is a glorious and courageous death, defending Merry and Pippin. It is what corrupts Saruman completely, the temptation of power, his foolish illusion that he can become another great power of evil equal to Sauron to rule Middle Earth. And even Gollum the Great, he thinks to himself as he scampers around. And so you see some who resist the temptation of power, and then you see others who don't resist it, who give in to the corrupting nature of power. And what power does, of course, once people have been tempted by it and given into it, is people who give in to power immediately stop treating other people as people, as people worthy of respect and love and honor, but treat them rather as objects to be used by them in the furtherance of their own power. And this is a very profound understanding of what happens to people in power, whether it's in business or politics or any other area in our society, if we're not very careful. Every Christian ought to understand very well that if you have power, you should demand that restraints be placed on your power, that there be checks and balances. It's one of the glories of Christian contribution to our political systems in the West, the insistence on limitations placed on those in power. But where this doesn't happen, we see terrible consequences as people are used simply by Saruman, by Wormtongue, by Denethor. All three of these are portraits of the corrupting nature of power. In contrast to that, we see the delight by Tolkien in these stories of power used not for self-glory, but power used to serve other people. And this, I think, is one of the most beautiful themes of these books, to see people with power who have no sense of vainglory, but who delight in using their power to serve others. Aragorn, of course, is a wonderful example. He is a king, and yet he is a servant. And as you read the appendices and as you read this text carefully, you will know that he's already spent a couple of generations serving without any desire for glory or personal honor in the kingdom of Rohan for a generation, and in the kingdom of Gondor for a generation, under an assumed identity. He serves them in the battle against evil. He is a servant, and at the beginning of the story, when we first meet him, he is a servant of the Shire, and they haven't any idea that this is the person who's actually protecting them and keeping their quiet and beautiful landscape and culture safe from the ravages of evil. He is a servant king, and Tolkien has portrayed him beautifully as such. Gandalf is also a servant. Gandalf, of course, is in fact an angelic being who has been sent by Eru, by God, the One, into this world for a time to be a servant. So is Saruman, of course, but Saruman refuses the call to be a servant and assumes power for himself. But Gandalf is a servant, though he has more power than any other character of the good characters in these stories. But he is totally uninterested in praise, in power for himself. It is all used in the service of other people. The elves are a wonderful picture of this service as well. Galadriel and Celeborn say, "We must diminish that others may flourish." They understand very well that taking the stand they do in this battle against evil, using their power for the service of hobbits and men and other creatures in Middle-earth, they are going to dwindle away. Their glory will diminish And it's fascinating. It's kind of like a commentary on John the Baptist's words. And related to this, power used not for self-glory but to serve others, is the theme of self-sacrifice. This is a theme that comes out over and over again in these stories. It is true of Arwen, who sacrifices up her life, her eternal life as an elf, to serve and to love Aragorn. Faramir, who is always first in the battle and last to retreat, he is somebody who gladly is ready to sacrifice himself for the people whom he rules and leads. Aragorn, of course, the obvious example of this, of somebody who seems to have absolutely no regard whatsoever for his own personal safety, but is always thinking about how he may serve others, even if it means giving up his life. It's true of Gandalf, and of course Gandalf does indeed plunge to his death, protecting the fellowship in Moria, only to be raised up again to serve for a brief time longer. The elves who join in the battle, many of whom will die, and they know that perfectly well, but they sacrifice their lives that others may live. And of course, Frodo and Sam, at the very heart of this story, they have no expectation whatsoever that they will return when they go to throw away the ring. No expectation. They have no water, no food. They have come to the end of their energy completely. They have given themselves as much as they can possibly give themselves, and they expect simply to die. But they do so out of love for others. The theme of self-sacrifice, which is celebrated in these books in a wonderful way. There's also what I've called here the beauty of weakness and folly. Again, I think there is much in these books that's like a commentary on Paul's words in 1 Corinthians chapters 1 and 2, when Paul speaks about God's folly being wiser than the wisdom of this world. Tolkien nowhere quotes that exactly, but there are many places where you can see that this is the theme that he is dealing with. And of course, we see it as Christians, supremely in the death of Christ. But that's what this story is about. God uses the weak things of the world to confound the mighty. And Gandalf is constantly talking about this in relationship to the hobbits. They are so small. Nobody notices them. They are insignificant. They are just little people. As Schaefer said, there are no little people in God's world. And that's true of the hobbits, or the destruction of the ring itself. Gandalf calls this the supreme act of folly, which is so foolish that Sauron cannot possibly imagine that they would do this. Sauron's assumption is that Aragorn must have the ring, and they play on that assumption, of course, as Sam and Frodo make their way to the crack of doom to cast it away and destroy it. So the beauty of weakness and folly. And then finally, I want to speak about what I'm calling here the unseen and unheard backdrop to everything in these books is the biblical story. The biblical story of God's originally good creation, of this present broken and fallen world because of rebellion and sin, and the longing for the restoration of what is good. Now, Tolkien himself, long before he wrote The Lord of the Rings, had a particular view of myth, which has become to be known as the mythopoeic view of myths and legends and fairy stories. And you'll see in your notes there, I've got some sections from a poem of Tolkien's called Mythopoeia. Now, Tolkien wrote that poem, and some of you may know this, some of you may not, but Tolkien wrote that poem, Mythopoeia, after a very long conversation with C.S. Lewis in 1930. This was just before Lewis became a Christian. They were already very good friends, and Tolkien had been praying for Lewis many conversations with him, but one night they had a conversation with another friend, Hugo Dyson, the three of them, walking around Addison's Walk in Oxford till 3 o'clock in the morning. And this was what their conversation was about. Sometime before, Lewis had come to believe in God. He had also started attending church regularly. And he believed that Jesus was a historical person who died and rose again from the dead. He'd been persuaded of the resurrection. But Lewis had not yet become a Christian personally, because obviously there's more to being a believer than simply believing these things are true. And Lewis's problem was this, and he shared his problem with Tolkien on that particular evening. He said, "I cannot possibly see what significance the facts of the death and life and resurrection of Christ, what significance things that happened 1900 years ago could possibly have on my life today. What possible meaning can they have to me?" Lewis found church basically boring. Sometimes, of course, it is. They had this conversation, and what Tolkien said to him was this. He said, "All through your life, since your childhood," and if you've read C.S. Lewis's Surprised by Joy, you'll know this about him, "all through your life since childhood, you have loved fairy stories and legends and myths." Lewis got joy from northernness, from the legends of Iceland and the far north. He had this, created a kind of longing in him. And later on he says, of course, this is what God used to bring him to himself. But that night, Tolkien said to him, "Lewis, you have no problem whatsoever in delighting in these myths and legends and fairy stories. And they give you joy and pleasure now. In their case, they're not true at all, and you know perfectly well they're not true. And yet you delight in them. You know they're not about things that actually happened." He said the gospel works in exactly the same way. Though it is true, it is historical fact, but it works in the same way. In fact, Tolkien went on to say, "All the myths and legends and fairy stories from cultures all over the world are actually simply echoes of the one true story, which the gospel tells us in the story of creation, fall, and redemption. These are memories, often very distorted memories, that these are memories of the truth. And that is why they move you so deeply. And if the lies with elements of truth in them, with echoes and memories of truth in them, move you deeply, well, how much more should the true story move you deeply?" C.S. Lewis responded to him in some famous words, which Tolkien quotes at the beginning of the poem Mythopoeia. That's like lies breathed through silver. That was Lewis's response: lies breathed through silver. And that's what Tolkien writes. He says, "To one who said that myths are just lies breathed through silver." Now, they had this discussion till 3 a.m. A few days later, Lewis became a Christian on his way to Whipsnade Zoo in the sidecar of his brother's motorbike. God used this conversation and Tolkien's understanding of myth and legend to help bring Lewis to faith. It was one of the many stones, one of the final stones that the Lord used to build the building of his kingdom in the heart and life of C.S. Lewis. It's just a few days, less than 2 weeks later, that Lewis becomes a Christian. And you'll see the quotations I've got here, and I'll finish with these. This isn't the whole poem, but just some elements of it. Tolkien wrote, "The heart of man," and he wrote this poem to Lewis, "the heart of man is not compound of lies, but draws some wisdom from the only wise, and still recalls him. Though now long estranged, man is not wholly lost or wholly changed. Disgraced he may be, yet is not dethroned, and keeps the rags of lordship once he owned. Later he goes on, whence came the wish and whence the power to dream? Or some things fair and others ugly deem? All wishes are not idle nor in vain. Again, reflecting there on we know in the deepest level that there is ultimately a difference between good and evil. And our longing for, our dreaming of what is good and beautiful. And then he comes to his theme of the legend makers. He's already used this beautiful expression of the rags of lordship. It's a beautiful way of describing the human condition. We are the image of God, but God's image is defaced in us. What Calvin said, Calvin's image, was that human beings are like ruined statues in which we still see the outlines of our former glory. Tolkien speaks of the rags of lordship that we once owned. But then he goes on, blessed are the legend makers with their rhyme of things not found within recorded time. Then notice what he says. It is not they that have forgot the night or bid us flee to organized delight. Then writing about himself, he says, I would that I might with the minstrel sing and stir the unseen, that is the unseen world of God and his angels and of darkness, and stir the unseen with a throbbing string. I would with the beleaguered fools be told that keep an inner fastness where their gold impure and scanty. He's talking about legends and myths and fairy stories. The gold in them is pure, is impure, and it's scanty. But I would rather be told with them, he says, I'd rather be one of them. Yet they loyally bring to mint an image blurred of distant king, or in fantastic banners wave the sheen, heraldic emblems of a lord unseen. Now notice those words. That's what Tolkien's trying to do in The Lord of the Rings. Precisely this, in creating this myth, because that is what he has done. This legend for the English people. It is the memory of paradise that we once owned. It is the realization of paradise lost, the longing for paradise to be regained. And above that, even beyond that, it is the memory of and longing for a distant king, a lord unseen. It is that memory and that longing that is present behind every moment of this story. It is this that is the most powerful evocation of the quest for goodness. And it is this, I believe, that touches every reader of the books and every viewer of the films at a much deeper level than they realize. Now I'll stop there and we will open this up for discussion and questions. We've got some things here so that your questions can be recorded.
I read a book.
It's on. Yeah, it's on.
Okay. I read a book by Tom Shipley.
Yes.
Called Tolkien Author of the Century. Yes. And in it, Shipley says that what Tolkien presents is sort of a hybrid between a Christian vision of redemption and the sort of tragic vision of the twilight of the gods, uh-huh, of Valhalla. And I'm not convinced by all of it, but there is something to that. You know, within the ring, there is the power. It must be destroyed, but in destroying it, you break the spine of the world.
Yes.
And everything into the third age becomes shabby and less than it was. Mm. Those sorts of points where the elves are between a rock and a hard place, and there is no way out but down.
Yes.
Sort of.
That's a very good question. There are many different kinds of legends and myths, particularly from the various parts of the Germanic-speaking world,
from Scandinavia right down through Germany and into Britain, which are present in these stories. There's no question about that. I don't think Tom Shipley actually fully understands Christianity himself. I don't know whether he's personally a Christian. I ought to go find out. He actually teaches in St. Louis at the moment, not far from where I live and work, at St. Louis University there. And it would be interesting to get to meet him and find out where he's at personally. And I've used his book myself in the class I taught last year on Tolkien at the seminary. But of course there are elements, some other mythologies here. There's no question about that. Tolkien is not trying to write a consistent Christian allegory. And he's absolutely clear about that. The point I'm making is a very different one. And that is, at the deepest level, Tolkien has the view that all human myths and all legends, the Germanic ones included, have echoes of the true story, the Christian story. So for him to use elements of Germanic myth or of Icelandic myth doesn't in any way put it at odds with Christianity. Not at all, because he sees these things as being echoes of the true story. Now, it certainly isn't a carefully worked out Christian myth in which you can see at every point some direct correlation with the biblical story. That's not at all what I'm suggesting. I'm suggesting that at a kind of background level, there is this true story which is always present there, different elements of it, the things that he celebrates. Now, I think your point about the sadness of this world, that things are going down, you might say, I think that also I think there's also a deeply Christian element in that too. Aragorn himself says at one point that there is no healing for many of our sorrows within the circles of this world. That's true. The Christian knows that better than anybody else. Sometimes as believers we speak very superficially about the problem of evil and suffering. But the Bible never suggests to us that our wounds are healed in this world. Our tears won't be wiped away till we stand before the Lord. So there is a kind of a very deep sense of the sorrow of the human condition which comes through these stories. And we see this in the story of the elves very clearly, but in many other ways as well in these books. I was very moved a month or two ago. We have a nephew in California. He's a young man who was had leukemia when he was two. And the chemotherapy had to have damaged his brain, as well as making him sterile and many other problems. And he's not exactly simple, but his IQ is quite significantly lowered. We have been encouraging him to read things which are a little more challenging, because he was basically reading Star Wars and things like this, and he got into The Lord of the Rings. And he loved it, and he loved the movies, but he couldn't cope. What he couldn't cope with was the sorrow of it. The thing that he could not handle was that Frodo couldn't stay in Middle Earth and enjoy the fruits of his victory, that he is so deeply wounded. Now, I believe that, I don't think this is some pagan element, which I think is what Shipley is suggesting. In fact, he's suggesting it quite clearly. I don't think this is a pagan element that Tolkien has brought into these stories. I think it's a thoroughly biblical one, with a very deep understanding of the terrible reality of evil and the brokenness of our lives, which even with the knowledge of Christ does not get fixed in this world. And that's the point that Tolkien is getting across. But our nephew, Wyatt, he just couldn't cope with it. I mean, this was overwhelming to him. And he said, I'm never going to read them again. Yes, do you want to pass it along?
It's absolutely my experience, and when I read The Lord of the Rings, I felt devastated inside, and for many years I couldn't touch Tolkien's books because I felt it brought such a deep sorrow inside that I put in a box somewhere, and I didn't deal with it, but I felt it was there, and I felt strange. I feel that, so I couldn't. I felt embarrassed almost by the wound that it caused in me. And once I decided to read the Silmarillion, and that absolutely healed that wound inside. And because what I understood was that when the elves, what that caused the pain, that when the elves left Middle-earth, and I felt that it was the beauty of the land left, or somehow what made it really valuable left. And in the Silmarillion, the elves came down to the level of creatures, and I understood that there was the one who created everything, and there was this West that I got to know more about, and where they went back to. And so I got a bigger picture that I didn't get from The Lord of the Rings. Yeah. So I advise everyone to read the Silmarillion after that.
To have their wounds healed, yes. Yeah, that's a great point. I think that actually it's there in The Lord of the Rings too. But there are sections of The Lord of the Rings which are a little bit more like the book of Ecclesiastes, if we want to use that as an image, where the dominant theme of the book of Ecclesiastes is the sorrow of the human condition. And yet there are, if you like, glimpses of light and redemption, though they're not fully developed. And The Lord of the Rings is a little like that, certainly some elements of it, where there is this very deep sense of the power of evil and the brokenness of our world. And but again, you see, it's thoroughly biblical. There is going to be no healing of this world until Christ comes back. No full healing until he comes to establish his kingdom. And there are hints of this in The Lord of the Rings, that there is going to be a final resolution of things. Now, Arwen, for example, when Aragorn lays down and dies, is devastated. But he says to her, we will meet again. You know, there is going to be a resolution to this one day. Now, I think when... Yeah, what I would say to people who feel deeply wounded by it is, are there sorrows in one's own life that one hasn't dealt with? In my nephew's case, his mother left, committed adultery, and married somebody else when he was 10 years old, and for 3 or 4 years didn't want to have anything to do with him. It's devastating to him. And he's never dealt with it. He finally has a relationship with her again. When she finally wanted to get back in touch, he wouldn't read her letters. He would never answer the phone in case it was her. No, he just has never been able to deal with this. And I think that what happened to him in reading this story and in seeing this film was it touched this thing in him which he has not been able to deal with, of this very deep sorrow. And you know, there are many, many people who have those kinds of very deep sorrows, and what Tolkien does, and it's a very powerful thing, is he brings those to the surface, and it's actually healthier to deal with them rather than to pretend. And my prayer for our nephew is that at some point he'll be able to actually work this through, and to face up to this sorrow and know that it has to be faced, even though there's no resolution to it in this life, because this is not a thing that can be fixed. There are many, many troubles we have in this world that will never be fixed until we meet the Lord face to face. And that's why Revelation ends with it does, with our tears being wiped away and things being made new. But Tolkien has a very deep sense of this, which is there all the way through the book, that yes, there will be victories, wonderful victories against evil, sacrifices, redemption, healing, restoration of landscapes and people and relationships, but all of them are temporary in this world. There isn't a final victory here against evil. He uses the expression, it's Galadriel, says, we fought the long defeat. That again is biblical. From our perspective, I remember Schaefer once preaching a sermon on death, and it's one of the most powerful sermons and one of the most simple sermons I've ever heard in my life. He just started reading through the scriptures, this whole series of statements, hundreds and hundreds of them, where it just simply said, and he died. He spoke about Adam and Eve, and they died, and so on, and he died. And he was just simply making the point of their death is our final enemy, and it hasn't yet been destroyed. Well, Christ has defeated it, but for us it hasn't been destroyed. It's going to be, and that's where what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15. And Tolkien has a very acute sense of this, that the last enemy, death, has not yet been destroyed. And we are in a situation where the book of Revelation puts it, the devil has come down and is raging because his time is short. And that's what you sense as you read the Lord of the Rings. The devil is raging because his time is short.
And the story of Arwen, where she sacrifices her life.
Yes.
But this is again, it comes through the Silmarillion that the elves live forever.
Yes.
But their pain grows because they have memories,
mm-hmm.
and but men die, but mm-hmm. they have a chance to live with Ilúvatar.
Yes.
I don't know if you say it in English.
Yeah, there are hints of resurrection actually in the Lord
of
the Rings.
So basically, when she becomes a human,
mm-hmm.
she is saved for eternity mm-hmm. or
yes.
for a life. So I see redemption in mm-hmm. the story, and I appreciate human life. Mm-hmm. much more after
yes.
the Silmarillion. And I was thinking a bit of the difference between the biblical view and the romantic view of
mm-hmm.
of life. And the elves represent for me a kind of romanticism where
mm-hmm.
that you long for eternity, but it's more and more painful and
mm-hmm.
and lasting. Whereas the biblical redemption is it has death, but it has also resurrection.
Yes. Yeah, that's a wonderful point. I think that's right. There, in fact, when you read The Lord of the Rings again, and the more carefully you read it, you'll see there are all sorts of hints of resurrection and the ultimate making new of all things, which are present repeatedly in the book, as well as these constant statements about God's divine sovereignty and providential rule over the affairs of this world. There is an extraordinary depth to them, theologically as well as in many other ways, in these stories. Yes.
I know tomorrow you're going to look at Harry Potter.
Yes.
And I wonder, for those of us who are not able to be in this stream, if you could make a few comparisons and also touch on the fact that a facile reading of Lord of the Rings might lead one to conclude that there are good witches and good wizards and bad wizards, that Tolkien would actually choose that kind of imagery that might suggest white magic and black magic.
Yeah, I don't want to get into this too deeply because I am going to be talking about Harry Potter tomorrow, and obviously that's one of the issues I have to deal with there. But I'll just say simply here that I think when people are bothered by the magic and the wizards, good and bad, whether it's in Tolkien or C.S. Lewis's Narnia stories, as I know people who will not read the Narnia stories because of the wizards in them and the magic, and they assume that this is by its very nature occult. I think there's just a deep misunderstanding of all sorts of things, of the life of the imagination, of the imagination of children, and of the purpose of magic, if we might call it, in that setting. starting with the last one first, I think that with Tolkien, for him, wizards and magic are simply a way of presenting the good and evil supernatural. It's all they are. It's just a name. Gandalf is an angel who is here in this world. Because he is an angel, he has extraordinary power. Sauron is a fallen angel. Because he is a fallen angel, he has extraordinary power. He is a liar and a deceiver, just as Satan is presented as a liar and a deceiver in Scripture. Gandalf, on the other hand, is somebody devoted to the service of God in faithfulness. And he is a, to quote Scripture, he is a ministering spirit sent to serve. I would say, I know many Christians struggle with it, but to see it as magic in the occult sense is to miss the point, because it's just a device for talking about the reality, the unseen reality behind this world, the reality of good and evil, which has its constant impact on our world here. That'd be my first response to it. So rather than being bothered by it, we should delight in it, because these are books which are helping us to understand something about the depth of the reality of the battle between good and evil that we experience in our lives. Like the Apostle Paul says in Ephesians, our battle is not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers, spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. And that's one of the themes that Tolkien is exploring. And at the same time, the work that God is doing to care for his people, both directly in his providential rule and his answer to our prayers, and also in sending his angels to serve us. In Tolkien's story, of course, the angel actually comes into the world in the person of Gandalf. But that's all it is. It's nothing more than that and nothing less than that. The second point I'll make, though, has to do with many Christians. They have a fundamental concern, whether it's about Lewis or Tolkien or Harry Potter, has to do with what they see as the danger of magic to children, the danger of this kind of fantasy. And my response would be simply this: every little child has an extraordinary imagination. Every little child will invest magically their animals, their cat or their dog, their guinea pig, their dolls, their action figures, cardboard cutouts, pieces of paper. They will invest them with life. And sometimes they will say magic words so that they will have this life. And they don't have to read books like this to start doing these things. This is what all children do. And these things take on a life of their own. They speak, they have conversations, they sleep, and they do good and they do bad. They get punished and commended. Every child plays like this. It's perfectly natural to play like this. And what Tolkien himself believed, and C.S. Lewis about this, was that God has made us, we might say, as sub-creators, and that the play of a child, before it gets crushed by adult supposed sophistication, that the play of a child is a reflection of this, that fundamental to our human nature is that we are creators who can create worlds in our imagination, not actual worlds, but we are imitating God as we do so. And for any little child, there's going to be all sorts of magical elements to this. They don't for a moment think they're real, that the dog is actually going to speak, or the cat, or the guinea pig, or that their doll will speak, or their RoboCop, or whatever it is. But they invest them with power. And it's simply an expression of what it means to be a person made in the image of God, who has been given dominion, who's been given the gift of language, and who has been given the gift of creativity. And I don't think we need to be at all bothered by fantasy in that sense. even magical fantasy with witches and wizards or anything else, because this is something which is perfectly natural to children. Not because they're fallen creatures, but because they're made in the image of God. And that's exactly the point that Tolkien is making in the poem Mythopoeia, that this is something which exists in every human culture, not because we're fallen, but because we are made by God. These are the rags of our lordship. You see a little child playing fantastic games. This is the rags of their lordship. And these are things to encourage, not to discourage, I would say. That doesn't mean that all fantasy is good, but that's a different question. Because obviously people who have evil intentions can write fantasy in which they hope they desire to seduce people into wickedness. But that's certainly not what Tolkien is doing, and it's not what C.S. Lewis is doing, and personally I'm quite confident that it's not what J.K. Rowling is doing either, but we'll talk about that tomorrow. But that's a very good question. But I really do think it's a deep misunderstanding, both of magic, if we want to use that word.
You're not suggesting...
Can you still make a comment, even one sentence, just on the use of magic and wizards then with Harry Potter in comparison?
I'll make one comment. I don't want to say too much in case some of you are coming tomorrow, but I'll just simply say this. I have never yet come across an example of a child who identifies with any of the bad characters in Harry Potter. I'll just simply say that. And I've read some very interesting studies, things written by psychiatrists working with very, very severely damaged children who have been abused in all sorts of ways by thoroughly evil people who read these books and only identify with the good characters and find the books tremendously encouraging in that sense. And that's as much as I will say now. I will just simply say this. I think that these books are a celebration of virtue. The Harry Potter books are a celebration of virtue. That's my considered opinion, and I'll talk more about that tomorrow. But I won't say anything else now, because if anybody wants to come tomorrow, we can talk about it. Yes, do you want to get the microphone there?
Thank you. For me, it was very interesting when Frodo had to make a decision to permit to Sméagol to lead them, him and and Sam, to the land to Mordor.
Yes.
Actually, he had to trust to evil.
Yes.
Could you?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, that Frodo has to choose to trust, at least to some degree, Gollum. To lead them into Mordor. And one of the themes that comes out over and over in the book is that even things which people who choose evil intend for evil, God can use for good. Now, for Christians, the supreme example is the death of Christ. Now, the devil brings it about through seducing Judas to betray Christ. But as Paul says, the rulers of this world didn't understand the secret wisdom of God that he decreed before the ages for our salvation. It's what Lewis calls in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, the deeper magic. Coming back to the word magic, the deeper magic from before the dawn of time. He's simply talking about God's divine providence and sovereign power over history. When he uses that term. Now, that's what you're seeing in The Lord of the Rings over and over again, where even evil characters, without realizing it, are serving the purposes of God, the purposes of good. And Gollum is needed at the end, actually, to help destroy the ring. He needs to be there, because Frodo is not going to be able to do it by himself. The ring is simply too powerful for him. To cope with its seduction. Of course, Gollum only has evil intentions. At that point, he has made his choice for evil, for Gollum rather than Sméagol. you remember the discussion, and it's brought out very powerfully in the film. In the book, of course, the discussion is more detailed, but Jackson does a wonderful job with it. He's having this discussion, and then he chooses for the evil, and what he chooses is to lead them via Shelob's lair so that he can get the ring. So his intentions are completely evil. But Frodo trusts him, and in the providence of God, we may say, and Tolkien constantly refers to this throughout the story without using the term the providence of God, that does bring Sam and Frodo safely with some lots of problems on the way, almost killed, etc., several times, into Mordor. But without Gollum, they would never have got there. It's rather like the statement in Genesis when Joseph's brothers first planned to kill him and then sell him into slavery. You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. And in a way, you might say this is Tolkien's commentary on that biblical text, certainly on that biblical notion. Yeah. But that's a great question. Yeah.
Just one sentence. And it was, I think it was still a good example of providence, because God did not just turn it into good, but he really meant it for good. So Gollum's Absolutely. Character was there from the beginning, yes, in the plan. Yeah.
That's right. We see Gollum all the way through the story, serving its purposes. So it's not sort of, it's not an accidental thing. It's the purpose of God. And Gandalf says this. He says, he doesn't say in the providence of God, but he says something very similar. I see, he says, it's like he's looking into the mind of God, I see that he still will serve some purpose in this venture. He says that on several occasions, and it's just fascinating. And that's one of those things where there's this constant reference to the unseen Lord or the distant king that Tolkien says in that poem.
One of the things I found interesting in Lord of the Rings is it's got such a sense of place, and not just the way you'd a typical author would describe a place, but each landscape has its own sort of personality,
yes.
and sometimes it comes alive, you know, like a Caradhras and these other places that actively resist the party. And I'm just wondering where that comes from. Is it his reflection of a fallen world, you know, Old Man Willow, this wicked created thing that shouldn't be moral here, or is it a sort of vitalism? Is it a sort of mysticism? What is he getting at?
It's an interesting question. I think what he's getting at, and of course he's using legends and fairy stories again, which have such things in them, mountains which are opposed to you, trees that want to swallow you up. There are fairy stories with these kind of elements in them. But what you have in Tolkien, I spoke in my lecture about the abuse of dominion. Now, one of the themes of Scripture, the way I've given a lecture many times called the seven-pointed curse, that the fall has seven effects on us, and I won't go through them all, but the final one, the final point of the curse, is the alienation, the brokenness, the frustration of nature itself, that nature itself is so deeply damaged by the fall that it actively resists us, our attempts at dominion. And Genesis speaks about this, that instead of your work being a joy to you and fulfillment, the earth will bring forth thorns and thistles against you. There is no work in this world which is completely fulfilling, because we always experience the consequences of the fall, not just because of our own sin, but because God has cursed the earth so that it resists us. Paul says in Romans 8 that the earth is subjected to vanity by the will of its creator, and it groans in travail, that is, in childbirth, the pains of childbirth, longing for its own redemption. And what Tolkien has done here is to take these fairy stories and legends and so on about parts of the earth being malicious, and he has used them to express that biblical idea that we are living in a world where the actual physical earth in which we live is cursed. It resists our dominion, and the attempt across Caradhras is a very powerful example of that. And there are others, of course, as well in the story, as well as Old Man Willow. But so it's not just that we directly abuse our environment, like Sauron and the damage he does to Mordor, or Saruman and cutting down the forest of Fangorn and so alienating the Ents and the other people and creatures that live there, but the earth itself resists our dominion, and it's that element that's coming out there, and it isn't simply pagan, there's also a Christian element to that as well.
It's interesting, in the movies it was almost as if Peter Jackson couldn't. I mean, he does in Fangorn, but he can't do it in, you know, where Gandalf shouts out, "It's Saruman!" as they're crossing Caradhras. It has to be personalized in the bad guy. Yes. It can't be the land itself.
Yes. Well, it's actually in the story, it's rather difficult to tell because there seem to be two elements present. One is of Saruman himself trying to prevent their journey to cause trouble for their journey. He's the one who sends these birds out that see them before this happens. And so you have this very strong sense Saruman, who has very great power, is trying to prevent their passage. But also the mountain itself, which has this evil in it, so to speak. And both elements actually come out in the story. So what Peter Jackson has done there is he emphasizes in particular Saruman's efforts to resist them, but he doesn't get rid of the other one entirely. Anybody who's lived as a farmer, my father-in-law is a farmer in California, and two of my brothers-in-law, you constantly battle the elements. You may do everything you can, and then you get a hailstorm, destroys your livelihood for the year. That's reality. The human beings living in this world. We live in a world which is subject to a curse. Now, the scripture isn't suggesting there are actually spirits in trees and mountains that resist us in that sense, as if they were actually inhabited by demons, which is the implication. That's where in Tolkien you get elements of pagan legends as well, but there's a thoroughly biblical idea which he's presenting to us in that. Do you have a question? Okay. One back there, yes?
I'm fascinated to know what you make of that delightful character, Tom Bombadil, that you mentioned earlier.
Yes.
That lovely interlude early on,
yes,
in the first book.
I think Tom Bombadil is like a sort of nature spirit. He, again, is something from other mythologies rather than from anything. You can't relate him to anything specifically Christian. And one isn't intended to. As I said, this is not a carefully worked out Christian allegory where you can look at everything and say, here is something which reveals something that the scripture speaks of. Tom Bombadil is Tolkien's first creation of Tom Bombadil is in a whole pile of poems he wrote for him, and you probably read them. There's a little book of poetry about Tom Bombadil and his relationship with the hobbits, and it's they're absolutely delightful. Well, he's developed him a little bit in the story to give him power, in Tolkien's whether you want to call it his bestiary or his order of creation, Tom Bombadil appears to be some kind of angelic being who is given responsibility for the earth, you could put it that way, and for the trees and the flowers and the streams and so on. But you can't really fit him into any kind of a biblical picture. But that's what he actually suggests about him, that he is one of the Maya, like Gandalf.
In terms of pagan saints, Well, he's more a nature spirit, actually, than a patron saint. So he's more pagan than Catholic, though there are elements of Catholicism in there, too. Yeah. You have a question? And then we probably better take this as our last one because it's supper time. But
can't really. I just find it interesting that the genre, right, of fantasy seems to be very... I think it's great because what it does, it gets people to think, okay, it's not about something, it's just leisure, and I read that story about this world out there, and in reality, there's so many truths about our life here. So, yeah. Do you think Christians should, more Christian writers should write good fantasy?
Yeah, or something else. You know, Tolkien made it up. I mean, he made up this genre, which has now, as I said, been imitated many, many times, but it certainly does give you the possibility. It's just exactly like Jesus' parables. I made this point when I was talking about Jane Austen. Her humor, which is wonderful, and Pride and Prejudice is the funniest book I've ever read, makes it possible for people to read this and be delighted by it and yet be confronted with extremely serious moral and spiritual issues. Because this is not simply a moral tale to give you moral instruction. So at the end of the day, you say, therefore, I should do this, and she is telling me directly to do this. She's telling you this delightfully funny story. But in the process, she's also communicating some very serious moral issues to us and spiritual lessons. Now, in the same way, Tolkien, in his fantasy, is doing something just like Jesus' parables or Jane Austen's novels. This is subversive. You know, this is a thoroughly Christian, thoroughly biblical book that he has written in the deepest possible way, which is for children and for adults is a wonderful challenge to genuine goodness and the hatred of evil, and some of the virtues that I said there, which are celebrated wonderfully in these books. You like these people. It's like with Harry Potter. Nobody wants to be like Malfoy or whoever it happens to be. They hate these characters, and purposely she presents them as hateful. Who wants to be like that? Now, it's the same in these books. Nobody will read them and ever identify with them. I would say nobody will, because there are people who are thoroughly wicked, of course, in the world, But you read these books and you are drawn into a delight in goodness because of the fantasy, because it's in another world, because the stories are so well told, all of these elements. But yes, it certainly works subversively. And I think many, many of the people who have been going to watch these movies have no idea why they like them so much and why they're going to keep watching them. Now, some of them will reflect on them. I've already had many conversations since this past Christmas about the last of the three movies with people who are not believers and explored with them some of the things they liked in them. And when I've suggested that actually, you know, it's operating at a deeper level than they realize, I say, well, why did you like the film? And they say, this fantastic story, you know, these wonderful special effects, etc., etc. And you can agree. And then they'll think a little bit deeper and they'll talk about the thoroughly realized world that is presented in the movies and is there in the books. But if you start pushing people a bit and getting them to think, people start acknowledging, yes, actually, you know, I really do see these people as being attractive people morally. And it's that kind of level, that depth, which is there, as well as the surface things, which I think is drawing so many people. And people will see them over and over again because of this, not simply because it's a good story, but because there are other things which touch them really deeply. And I think, as I started off by saying, Tolkien is a wonderful challenge to Christians who work in the arts, or in any other field for that matter, to see how it's possible to communicate truth in a way which is completely acceptable to our postmodern contemporaries, because it's not obvious. They're not being beaten over the head. You know, we're not forcing them to listen to moral tales. rather they're being delighted. Lewis said about his Narnia stories that while Christian children would read them and recognize immediately that they were about Christ, that Aslan was Christ, that he knew perfectly well that children with no acquaintance with Christianity wouldn't recognize this at all. But he saw them as a kind of pre-evangelism, that children would read them, and then later on they would come across the gospel, and some of them would fall in love with it because they recognized something that they already delighted in. Now, I think Tolkien is doing something very similar, and I know people personally who've become Christians through reading Lord of the Rings. You know, this is what God has used to begin to draw them to himself, just as God used myths and legends to draw C.S. Lewis to himself. And yes, I mean, it's a great question. I think you're exactly right, that the fantasy disarms people and draws them in. We need to stop there and head off to supper. Thank you for your excellent questions. And please do fill out these evaluations, otherwise I will get into trouble. And, just giving that point again, C.S. Lewis response.